when we were in Chicago, that was the first week of what they kept referring to as the directive. So tell me about the directive, exactly what it is that you were told as a player and your thoughts on it.
I haven't been a player that really liked to chat with the ref and have extended the discussion with the ref. I'm just focused on what I have on hand. So I don't really care about the discussion, but I just want to understand sometimes. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I want to understand what's going on. And then so for me personally, I just look at the ref and I'm like, can I talk? And then if I say it nicely, then they allow me to talk. And I have to smile, obviously.
Anything in the directive about not kicking doors? Was that mentioned?
Yes, obviously. Well, just to make it clear, like, it has nothing to do with the decision. That's the thing. It had nothing to do with the decision. It had to do with the fact that the official referee wasn't taking any decision.
Right.
He was throwing it to the video ref, and I'm like, just take a decision and then at least give him the chance to, like, at least give me the chance to review. And it was outdoors in Egypt, 40 degrees Celsius. So, yes. Yeah, it wasn't the easiest condition.
Right. Okay. No, I'm writing this down. No to kicking doors, right? That's what they said. No more kicking.
No.
Okay. About to leave. Already packing, come with me. I'm not really asking. We'll get away to a place where we don't know. What about this?
This call is being recorded.
Fans, we are back. But this is a special edition because it's another Buckshot, where Bill gets an interview with some of the most famous people in the world of squash. Bill, so who'd you have on this time?
Connor, you. Aren't you the most famous person in the world of squash? You're right.
Yeah,
there,
exactly.
Right? We can't have Gilly Lane on because Gilly does a podcast like every day at this point, so it's hard to track him down. So he's the second most famous person besides you. No, we had Noran Gohar.
I'm just honored to be in the conversation.
As am I. No, I was lucky enough to track down Noran Gohar. She was in London playing at the London Open at the Ali Pali. And you remember you and I tried to have an interview with Noran. I guess it was got to be close to a year and a half. 2 years,
yeah.
2 years now, and she had some connectivity issues because she was in Cairo and the internet wasn't great. But this worked out really well. She's a really good interview. She's so smart. She's so well spoken, and she's very introspective about herself and about the tour. So it was a lot of fun talking to her.
That interview a couple of years ago, I was so bummed because that was, I think, on track to be one of our best. Mm-hmm. She was so open. That was really. I've talked to her in the past, but she really just opened up a different side of her. Within the community, she's known as the Terminator. But what's your impression of her when you get her on the mic interviewing her?
For sure. And she's well aware of that. She knows she has that on court. And we talk about that, like how intimidating she is on court, the Terminator mode. And she says it's all business when she gets on court. And she thinks it's funny. And she doesn't know how to take it when people meet her in person and say to her, geez, you're so nice. You're nothing like I thought you'd be. And she doesn't know whether she'd be offended or not or be proud like that she has that kind of, it's like a Mohamed Al-Shabaghi situation, right? Where he comes off when he walks on court, he's just all business. You don't want to talk to him. You're almost a little intimidated by him. But then you meet him in the sauna and he's nice and chatty.
I do think there's an opportunity to get the sauna, an interview series with Bill in the sauna, but maybe when our production quality increases.
Yes, exactly. But yeah, no, it was good. She's obviously very smart, right? I didn't ask her to speak French. I did neglect to bring that up because that was one of the most surprising things. Remember when we saw her speak at the trophy ceremony in Paris? She spoke French, which was incredible.
In Paris. Yeah. So in this interview, what was the most surprising thing what surprised you in an interview about this?
Her view of, so we talked about Amina Orfi, right? I asked her about Amina because I said you had been through that same process as Amina, star junior, who then was thrown onto the PSA tour at a very young age. And how did you handle that? And she was so good talking about it. And it was the surprising part to me was, because I always thought as a junior player on the PSA tour, that's when you would feel the most pressure. You're in a strange space. You're with people who are older than you. You're probably ostracized, a little bit isolated because of your age. And she said that was the most fun she ever had playing squash, was when she first came onto the tour and there was no pressure. Nobody expected anything from her. And she was playing, stepping on court with her idols, basically. She said it was a dream come true. She called it and I think she may have just seen the Barbie movie. She called it a pink world. So
no,
I assume that's what she meant, was that she was referring to the Barbie movie, but I have not seen the Barbie movie yet.
One of the things also, it was interesting, is the time that you caught up with her, right? She's in London right now, and What's your impression of the London Classic right now?
The London Classic has been phenomenal. Just the venue has been great. The production has been tremendous. Just the, I am uber jealous of Michael Absalom being the MC for this event.
But that's, but that doesn't really give context here, because we feel like you're in perpetual jealousy of Michael Absalom. So how's this one different?
Because the atmosphere lends to his, he's good, let's face it, right? I could be jealous of him all I want and make fun of him all I want, but he's really good at what he does. And this venue is set up for someone like him with his enthusiasm, with his personality, and introing the players and interviewing the players and getting the crowd pumped up.
So I think this is an example, and it was hard to see how the Canary Wharf would be adapted into a new event. And here we see an example, I think, setting a new standard for the world tour. And this is an example of a truly PSA owned and operated event. So I think we're going to start seeing more events kind of raising the bar to this level. And for me, this sets just a new standard. The whole event design, I loving the pink, loving the continuity, the way that the players enter with the dramatic entrance, the glass court. I love that court, especially with the glass floors. It really lends itself towards just showcasing squash at the highest level.
Plus the way, adding the women. Canary Wharf was men only for years, and they added the women this year, and the women have provided the most drama on court and off the court. Without the women being there, we wouldn't get Emily Whitlock's complaint of the month, which is always good to get. But otherwise, the biggest upset of the tournament, we had Siva Sangari Subramaniam beat Noor El Shabini in the quarterfinals, which is just absolutely incredible. The stat that is being bandied about on the PSA socials is it was the first time Noor El Shabini has lost to a player outside the top 10 since 2015.
And it's amazing.
It is absolutely amazing. And on the men's side, we have Declan James, wild card, given the wild card. Declan James, who hasn't really been heard from in these big events in a long time, beat Karim Abdel-Gawad to reach his first ever gold semi. Absolutely incredible. Those two results, I always jokingly say, and it's funny the texts I get from friends of mine on the who are in the squash world, whenever there's a big upset on the women's side, I always say, oh, she must be pregnant. And of course, I'm like 2 for 20 on that. I was right about Raneem and I was right about Noor El Tayeb, but wrong about everyone else. It may be more Ramadan related, or it may be more just Siva played out of her mind, but there's Shabini upset. Or she got pregnant by looking at Declan James in his shorts. Declan James's shorts. Connor, have you seen this at all? Declan James wears tight shorts. He would impregnate me just by looking at him.
There's so much I can't touch here. The one other thing I would say is also in terms of Shabini upset is it's 2 out of 3.
Mm-hmm.
And think of how many times in early rounds Shabini will win in 5 in the early rounds. Mm-hmm. It's kind of, why is that player going to 5? So in this case, it would be to Siv's advantage to be able to get 2 quick wins.
Yeah, for sure. But again, we don't want to shortchange Siva at all, because let's face it, Noor knows it's 2 out of 3, right? So she knows that she can't get down 2 love and then become Noor El Shabini. I always wonder if the players who go up 2 love against her or 2-1 against her start thinking, hey, I'm about to beat Noor El Shabini. And in 2 out of 3, and Siva played great. I watched the replay of the match. And that's also the beauty of 2 out of 3, is watching the replays. It's just phenomenal. But you don't have to watch.
Yeah.
They're over in 35, right. 40 minutes. So it's been great. So yeah, so I've really enjoyed watching it. It's Easter Sunday morning. So the same thing that most Christians do on Easter Sunday, I'm going to go play golf. And so I'm going to have to watch the semis on replay when I get home tonight. Hopefully no spoilers will happen in that time.
One thing that just occurred to me before we close out and get on to the interview was you and I were having a text exchange or a conversation about the Olympic scoring.
Mm-hmm.
And you raised an interesting question. I think this is going to be an ongoing discussion point until basically the IOC and the LA 28 and the squash committee come to an agreement on this. But why don't you raise what you brought up?
Sure, I'll try to put, I actually brought it up to Noran in the interview too, but I think I probably didn't phrase it as well. So it took a little while to break through. But
you think take 2 is going to be better here?
Take 2 might not be better, exactly. So watching the 2 out of 3 in London, my thought was, because the prevailing notion right now is that the Olympics are going to be 32 draw on the men's and women's side, which is going to limit the amount of players who can compete. So my query to Noran and to others who I've asked, I said, would you prefer that instead of playing 3 out of 5 in the Olympics with a 32 draw, you do a full platinum draw and have it be 2 out of 3, and even 64 draw, make it even bigger and make it 2 out of 3, just to more players can play, more countries represented. You might get in the end, the early rounds probably wouldn't be as strong. But in the end, if you have, say, more Egyptians in the draw, it would probably be turn out to be a stronger tournament than, say, a third round of 32 where there's only two players per country allowed. So I was just wondering what people's thoughts on that. Additionally, the other reason is for non-squash fans, like people not like us, who are going to tune in for the first time and see this sport for the first time, is it more consumable to them in a 2 out of 3 basis where the matches are a little bit quicker and they're not going to sit there and watch an hour long of a match of a sport they've never seen before? That's very nuanced and might not seem very exciting if they don't know the sport.
Yeah, it's a really interesting question. And I think for the squash purists, we're really going to have to take a step back and realizing what we have a chance to be on the global stage and what does the global stage need. And so I'll share some of the direction that we're, or the feedback that we're getting is it's really designed for broadcast. And so that needs to have more predictable timing in terms of match length. So as an example here in London, the 2 out of 3 provides that. Like, it's really hard to extend that match beyond that. But so a 2 out of 3 format could be something we may have to do, and maybe not until the finals, right? You do a 3 out of 5 for the finals. So there are variations there. But then also crucial points. There's feedback that playing to point par 11, there's a lot of points that just don't really matter, whether it's 1-1, 4-4. It's really until you start to get to past the eights that there are crucial points there. And certainly the tie break, that contributes towards, while it's exciting and you go back and forth, it extends the timed. It doesn't make it as predictable. So, but to touch on the point of number of athletes, that is a hard ceiling right now that we've been admitted based, I believe, on 64 athletes total. That's currently in year one, and hopefully we get more events. Sorry, we get more opportunities at the Olympics. But right now, that's some of the criteria. So happy to hear any suggestions. And I think this is going to be an ongoing topic. So maybe we can couch this for another time. But it's a fun thing to think about. I wonder specifically for the London Classic, if you, because to your point, they've added the women's, would that change the approach? So you basically get two finals instead of one, right? So getting your money's worth for the fans. I don't know if that would change. Yeah, it's always a little bit weird switching the formats. I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah, me neither. I don't have any.
I think the experimenting is good, and just see how it turns out.
I think could have a full day of pro. I'm not going to tell Tim Garner or the PSA how to do their job, because obviously they're way better at it than I could be. But it seems like with 4 semis today, you can add programming into that if you need to extend the day for the fans. And in the finals, obviously the same thing. Started early with an exhibition, do something on court. The Egyptians are great at having like pre-tournament bands on court and things like that to make it more of a festival atmosphere. It's just
that's a good point.
My 2 out of 3 cents, if you will. How about that comment? I just came up.
That's a mic drop opportunity to go into the interview here.
Absolutely.
Anything else?
That's about it. Look forward to everyone. Give a listen, Noron. We do talk about the famous door kick at the World Tour Finals, and we also talk about her friendship, in air quotes, with Hania El-Hamami. Give a listen. It'll be interesting.
All right. Hope you guys enjoy.
Thanks, Connor. Now to welcome on a very special guest, the former world number one, currently the world number 3 player on the women's PSA tour. Welcome to Noron Gohar.
Thanks, Bill. Thank you for having me.
No problem. People behind the scenes don't know what we've gone through to make this happen. So
You are a very busy man.
Yes, I'm a very busy man working at home, bothering you on the road while you're trying to do your profession and be one of the best squash players in the world. Meanwhile, I'm sitting behind a computer basically just bothering you, saying, come on, Noron, where are you? I really appreciate you doing this. I always enjoy talking to you. But we tried to do this, I think, maybe about 2 years ago, and we had some connectivity issues when you were in Cairo. So now we're in London. You are playing at the Ali Pali. What's the atmosphere there? I've been looking on Squash TV. It looks pretty amazing.
It's amazing, actually. That's the word. I was just there today practicing, and it's beautiful. It's one of the best venues I've been to. I think I've been for some time on tour, so I've seen a couple of very nice venues, but this is obviously one of the on the top of the list. And yeah, last year, like, we had the same setup in Birmingham, but I would say this is even cooler.
And it looks like, even for an early afternoon day today, today is Thursday, so today was just second round action. It looked pretty full. There was some good crowd. I watched the Paul Call Timmy Brownell match. It looked like it was like almost 3/4 full, which is great.
Yeah, it's always great to see a full crowd, especially in the first rounds. You don't get that and a lot of events. It shows how special this event is and how well organized as well. A big shout out to the organizers and everyone that made it possible. For us as players, it's always great to come to new venues. Like sometimes you play at the same place for 10 years almost. So to have something new is always great to have.
Yeah, for sure. So what are you worried at all about the distractions of the loud crowd? I've watched darts from there and it seems like it gets pretty crazy with the beer drinking and gets loud. I'm very disappointed that Mohammed Al-Sharbagi is not playing in this event that he dropped out, because the thought of people making noise while he plays always thrills me. And I love watching when people like make noise around him and he death stares them. So what are your thoughts about playing in front of a somewhat rowdy crowd and maybe a crowd that's a little noisier than your normal squash crowd?
I would say Egyptian crowds are quite noisy as well. When they have an Egyptian playing, they're quite noisy, which is in our favor. So that's something I cannot complain about.
Right.
And in the US as well, like TUC, for example, it's a great atmosphere. Mm-hmm. People get really like energetic and really behind the player that they like. So I love this as well. And I played TUC when I was very young, mm-hmm. and they always look for upsets. I was glad that I was on the like underdog side so that they support me a bit.
Right.
Yeah, here in England, I love the English crowd in general because I feel like they're very knowledgeable about the game. They're very fair as well. Even if you're playing an English woman, like they would still tap for good shots. Mm-hmm. And that's great to see as well. So anyways, like having big crowd is always very pleasant for us. Obviously, you want them to be on your side, but if it's not, you try to make them on your side.
I think it's interesting because talking to you now, and I talk to you when I see you at events, and you're so very personable and so always smiling, always happy. And then you switch to Terminator mode once it comes to on court. So I'm wondering if someone maybe stands up while you're serving a big point, you might give them the Terminator stare outside the glass there.
Yeah, I always get this comments of after matches or something, if I smile or say like a joke or something, and they're like, oh, but you're actually nice. It's, I don't know if I should take it as a compliment or a bad thing, but yeah, encore, I always feel like it's business on court. There's no time to joke around. Like, that's how I am on court. Mm. And that's how I was raised in a way, like in everything, in my studies and squash. I take it very seriously because I put a lot of effort and heart into this. I don't take it easy for sure.
No.
But I'm not that intense in my everyday life. No, I'm not that intense. Like, we can ask my family and people around me. They're like, she's one of the people that I would joke around on anything, everything. And because if it's too intense that way, I would die, I think.
Right, off the court and on the court. I just listened to the podcast you did with your husband, which was phenomenal, by the way. That young woman whose name escapes me right now. So if you want to, you know her name?
Reem Abulail, yeah, she's amazing. She's one of the best and most talented people.
Oh, for sure. So I recommend highly, anybody has a chance to listen to the podcast with you and your husband. She's also doing on other Egyptian athletes who are Olympic bound. Is that her series? Is that correct?
Yes. Yeah, so the series is called Abtal, which means champions in Arabic. And it's basically, she has chosen, I think, 8 athletes that qualified for Paris. And they're all very inspirational. Each and everyone has a very unique story and they're in different sports as well. So it's very interesting to listen to people from different backgrounds and different sports. Like, you will find similarities, but at the same time, everyone has their own unique story. So it's very inspiring. Like, I was a big fan of the series myself. I would listen to it every single episode. And yeah, it was a very nice talk for sure.
People want to see your real personality off the court. I highly recommend that. You and your husband did nothing but laugh and joke during that whole episode. It was so great to listen to.
He always liked to make fun of me.
He basically made fun of you the whole episode for sure. And pointed out that you and I had texted because we were trying to set this up. And I had said that there's some pressure on me because originally I sent the wrong email address. And I sent to your .com instead of your .edu. So that was my fault. And I mentioned that there was so much pressure on me because, according to the podcast with your husband, you are very officious about everything. He made it seem like, and then when I started listening to it a little closer, I was like, he makes it seem like the fact that she packs her bag for squash practice and puts all her equipment in there, he made that seem like that was a big deal. And I was like, that seems
exactly. Yes. That seems very basic, right?
It seems very basic. I had to re-listen to it a little bit because I was like, that seems pretty normal. She puts her rackets and her shoes in her squash bag. That seems like what you should do. So I'm fearful that your husband, when he gets out to Paris, is going to pull his foil out of his packet and it's not going to be there. Is that a chance that happening?
Hopefully it's his saber, not his sword. Oh. That's the one thing, because he's a saber bender.
Oh.
But I'm pretty sure he can. That would be a big problem, though.
That would be a huge problem. So that was interesting to talk, listen to him talk about his life as a fencer, but more so I was interested from your side, your what you go through when you watch him perform and the stress level, because I've seen him at quite a few of your events that I've emceed. He's been in the crowd and he looks pretty calm, cool, and collected when you're playing on the outside, on the outside anyways. But you say when you watch him, you like you, your outward emotions are for everyone to see, and you're basically lying on the floor, I think you quoted, watching him perform.
No, actually, I think maybe watched, like, obviously all matches are very hard, but if it was a very close match, I don't think he would have the same opinion, because he's, like, jumping all around the crowd, and it's just, it's good to see, like, I don't know if it's a good, obviously it's good because he cares,
right.
But at the same time, I don't want him to have a heart attack.
Right.
Yeah, so last year, like, usually because obviously our schedules are crazy and we don't get to be at the same place at the same time.
Right.
But last year, thankfully, he had the World Championships, which was obviously the biggest event after the Olympics during my off season. So I could be there watching him for the first time. I think it was my first time to be on site watching him live. And he was playing the quarterfinals in Italy against an Italian and the last Italian to stand there. And actually, during this event, the president of Italy was watching. So it was a huge, it's a huge thing there. Fencing obviously is very big in Italy.
Yeah.
And he was playing, he was fencing. So he hates it when I say playing, it's fencing. And it was 14-14. So their bout is from 15. Mm. And it's a sudden death in a way, like 14-14. There is like, that's the last touch. And then it was like 50-50 between him and the, and it's very like in fencing, refereeing is very hard and very subjective in a way. And obviously for me, I'm so lost at the beginning. I had no clue what happened. Uh-huh. Like I just see two people like attacking each other and it's like a huge fight.
Right.
And I have no clue what's going on.
Uh-huh.
And right now after watching a bit, like I can understand some rules, but obviously I don't get it all. And yeah. And then if he would have scored this point, he would medal for the first time ever in history. In Egyptian history, African, Arab history, and it was a big deal. And then after the match, I was like on the floor, like playing there. And then they're like, and then the thing is, in fencing, they play the whole tournament in one day.
Oh.
Like they play around 64, and then they rest for an hour, and then play around 32, and then rest for an hour, and then round 16. So I was there from 9 a.m.
Wow.
And and it's hard.
How long does a typical match, say the one that went 15 and it was sudden death, how long did that take?
Like maybe 15 minutes,
okay.
10, 15 minutes
okay.
with the decision. So it's very explosive, but it's not that long. But again, for me, the part that they like warm up, cool down, it's so hard. Like it's so hard and then it's very tough on the body. So yeah, so that was the fourth match of the day,
geez.
And it was quite intense, quite intense. And then they were like, semi-final is in that hour. I was like, I'm staying here, like I'm done with the day.
So tell me this.
At least I give him like rest days. He doesn't give me any rest.
Right, it's all the way through. But then again, the tournament's only one day, so quick in and out. So I'm gonna test your fencing knowledge and my lack of fencing knowledge, which you've already exposed. What is the difference between foil fighting and saber fighting?
There are three weapons in fencing,
okay.
foil and saber,
mm-hmm.
and the difference is the sword itself and the target.
Mm-hmm.
So for foil, it's only this part.
Okay.
Whereas for saber, you have the head as well and the back.
Okay.
Foil is the front and the back as well, but without the head. And in saber as well, like in foil, you can only hit with they call it the point, which is like the beginning of the weapon. Like you can only touch that way, but in saber, like you can hit sideways, front. So it's very quick. Like it's the quickest of the three weapons. Like when the ref says like play alley, it's like they go in a few seconds. Like.
Was the reffing better in fencing or is it better in squash?
Oh my god, that's a very, you're gonna put us in trouble here.
Oh, this is just the start of it. No, this is just the start.
No, to be honest, obviously in squash I would say it was easier to understand the decision.
Mm-hmm.
But for the last period of time, like I know that can be a stroke, so it's very subjective
right,
as well
right
now. And actually, yeah, fencing is very hard in terms of, because it's very quick and it's very opinionated, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
But in squash right now, we are having the same issue,
right? Yeah, so that's why I'm leading into that question about what we called.
Go get me.
No. This will be, and we'll cut anything that will get you in trouble. I promise, I'll cut out. When we were in Chicago, that was the first week of what they kept referring to as the directive. They kept calling it the player directive. They were very mysterious about it in Chicago. It didn't seem like they really enforced it that much because it was new and it seemed like the communication wasn't that great. But as tournaments have played since then, Cleveland, Optasia, it seems like they are enforcing it more and more. So tell me about the directive, exactly what it is that you were told as a player and your thoughts on it.
To be honest, in Chicago, I felt like the refereeing was not much better than the previous mm-hmm. event. There was a part in the season where it was very hard to understand for the referees and for the player. I felt bad for the referees as well. Like, it was very confusing in mm-hmm. a way. And then I feel like some players, they manipulated the rules in a way to get easy points because it was very confusing for everyone. But I feel like the referees are getting it now and they're understanding more, okay, when the player is really looking to play the ball or like going for the player. And this is something that as a player, like, it's very annoying when you feel like the other player is getting cheap points or like they're faking something or they're making it look like something and it's not really the fake. So I feel like the referees are trying their best, but to be honest, like, I've seen, like, they're trying to understand more what's going on. They're trying to watch a lot of clips. They're trying to improve every single day. And this is very appreciated by someone like me. Like, obviously, sometimes people don't see, but the referee is human at the end, and they're gonna do errors. Like, it's mm-hmm. all, and it's a very hard job as well, to be honest. Like, I remember one day I was, like, passing by, and they were, like, having a discussion about one of the calls, and they actually laughed about it and they were like, what do you think? And it was very hard to decide whether it's a stroke or a left, and it's like 9-all in the fifth, and
right.
But from a player's perspective, it's very frustrating as well, because you feel like, oh, I've been putting so much into this, a lot of effort, a lot of heart in this, and then I'm being like, the match has been like stolen from me, and this is the worst feeling to have. But again, I feel like consistency is key.
Mm-hmm.
Even if a referee has a different opinion than the player, but the most important thing is to make the player understand what they're thinking. Mm-hmm. Okay, I don't want you to do this. I don't want you to do this. I don't want you to be aggressive when you ask for a left. Or I want you to do more effort. So then the player can understand what the referee is waiting from. And I feel like lately they're trying to communicate better with us, so that nothing is better than seeing a free-flowing match. So I feel, and with all of the rules and the decisions, and it has been very scrappy. Like, it has been, there is a patch in the season where it has been very scrappy, and you're not allowing the players to play the free-flowing game that they want to play. And I feel like especially any top player, they don't want to win 2 points. That's not the solution, or that's not why we're playing.
Right.
But then also, you cannot allow the other players to win cheap points, because if they do that, then I'm talking about matches I've seen. Like, you're making players be more aggressive because you're not giving them the right call. Like, you're a simple left, you're like, no, let just go for the ball. So unconsciously, the player is going to be very aggressive when they go and play the ball. So I feel like there has been a lot of confusion, and right now it's getting much, much better, I would say. It's getting much better, and the directives that you're talking about, it's better. Obviously, sometimes the referees are like, shh, don't say anything.
Right. So that's what I was curious about. What do you think about the fact that you're not allowed to talk, like, even talk really much anymore on the court? My opinion is there should be that should be allowed a bit, because there is some entertainment value to that for sure. But it does go over the top. So your thoughts on not being able to, like, question and speak on court? Because you're one of the folks who you do like to talk to the ref and ask questions for sure.
I haven't been a player that really like to chat with the ref and have extended the discussion with the ref. I'm just focused on what I have on hand, so I don't really care about the discussion, but I just want to understand sometimes. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I want to understand what's going on. And then, so for me personally, I just look at the ref and I'm like, can I talk? And then if I say it nicely, then they allow me to talk. And I have to smile, obviously. Sure. And I remember one of the matches, actually, I think it's UC, I was playing the final, and then I think Roy was refereeing, and then I was trying to say something, and then he didn't want me to talk because he felt like I was wasting time or something. And then, or he thought that's enough, like, just let's keep on going. And I just did like this, and then I threw the key, and they actually laughed about it. So I think he wasn't happy about it that I was polite and I didn't say anything.
Is the directive to the players that you don't speak at all? Is that the directive?
No, it's just like they're trying, which I think is the right way to, because you don't want to see a player talking to the ref for 5 minutes. Come on. You want the play to, again, you want to be flowing. You want the play to keep on going. You want to see the squash. You don't want to see what, okay, once in a while you can see some entertaining, but that's not the game. Like, it's not about the player and the ref and how they talk to each other. And to be honest, I've seen a lot of examples where the players have been very aggressive towards the refs as well. And this is not acceptable.
Right.
And I think that's why we have been, like, put some, like, tough rules in a way that you cannot talk, so that at least, like, we saw from somewhere, okay, you cannot talk, so when you talk, you have to think about the way you're talking to
them. Got it.
And vice versa as well. Like, the ref should also respect the player. He shouldn't be going screaming at him, right, you have to do this. I'm not. Sometimes I'm just like, wow,
right,
what's going on? Like, there has to have to be like a mutual respect. I felt like lately it has been like a war between the players and the refs.
Yes.
Like, it has been like as if we're like on opposite sides,
right,
where it shouldn't be that way.
Right.
And another thing that I think about as well is that the ref shouldn't be the reason of the outcome of the match.
Right.
Like, he should be just there refereeing in a very neutral way. Mm-hmm. And then the best player should be the winner at the end of the match.
True.
Not the, because the ref did put some input, then it played a role in the result of the match. But again, I've seen improvement in Chicago, to be honest, compared, and TUC, there was some improvement compared to the previous event. So I think by the end of last season, it wasn't great. But since then, we have seen improvements, I would say.
Anything in the directive about not kicking doors? Was that mentioned?
Yes. Obviously. Well, just to make it clear, like, it has nothing to do with the decision. That's the thing. It had nothing to do with the decision. It had to do with the fact that the official referee wasn't taking any decision.
Right.
He was throwing it to the video ref, and I'm like, just take a decision and then at least give him the chance to, like, at least give me the chance to review. But you're not giving me, when you throw it to the video ref every single time, then you're not giving me the chance to use my review.
Right.
And that was 5 times in a row.
Yes.
After a 2-hour match.
Oh, yeah. So, I've rewatched that match several times.
And it was outdoors in Egypt, 40 degrees Celsius. So, yes. Yeah, it wasn't the easiest condition.
Right.
Okay.
No, I'm writing this down. No to kicking doors, right? That's what they said. No more kicking.
No.
Okay. I had to ask. So talk about your health, Noran. You obviously, after Qatar this season, you took some time off because of foot injury. Back 100%. Are we healthy 100%?
Yeah. So I had a very nasty injury, I would say. I've had it since the... So I had a pain in the heel since World Tour Finals. Actually, this match, the final match.
Not from kicking.
Not because
it wasn't a kicking the door injury.
It was the other foot. So, yeah. And then it kept on. No one really knew what it was. They were like, oh, it's like overuse. You had a long season.
Mm-hmm.
We played on glass floor as well. So it's a rougher surface than the usual court. And then during Paris, I had a tear in my plantar fascia and I didn't know. Oof. It was a 9mm tear during my quarterfinal match, actually. I pulled it. Like, I felt like a pull in my plantar fascia, but no one really knew. I was playing. I think it was too low, and in the third game, so I wasn't really feeling it. I was, like, warm, and then when I started cooling down, I could barely walk. I couldn't walk, and I pulled, and I was like, I feel like I have something that is not good. And obviously, I took painkillers and it wasn't doing anything. The pain was still there. I played my semifinal match. I have no clue how I won it. I won it and then I played the final. And then after that, we had like a training camp in Dubai. And then I went to Dubai. And when I got there, I was like, I need to see a doctor right now. I'm not. And I'm known for feeling pain. Like, it's like I'm quite resilient with pain. Yeah. Like, if I'm feeling I'm in pain, then it's a big issue. And then I saw one of the doctors, and then he did some testing, and then he's like, "I'm 90% sure you have a stress fracture." And I was like, well, I didn't hit my foot like that. I didn't kick the door with this foot. and then he told me, okay, you need to do an MRI. So I went to the MRI. And we were supposed to play Qatar in 2 days. So I needed to have an answer. Should I play? Shouldn't play? And then the MRI came out, but then the report wasn't ready. And I think it was an issue with the technician or something, and he didn't see that I have a fair of 9 millimeter.
Yikes.
And they were like, oh, you have a big inflammation, maybe it's that. So he's like, you just tape it and play, you'll be fine in Qatar. So I went to Qatar. I reached a point where I couldn't jog even to warm up. Like, I was just like warming up on the bike, and then I played the match.
Yikes.
I have no clue how I'm lunging, how I'm running, no clue. And then I got to the quarters, but then what stopped me wasn't easy, because no one really knew what was in my foot. Everyone was like, it's not like a muscle, it's something very like abnormal or not very usual to have. And I got really sick in Qatar, and that's what actually stopped me from playing. Like, it made me feel I was like, I got COVID actually. It ends up being COVID at the end. I knew after I finished my match, and then we were in Qatar anyway. My dad was there, and he's like, okay, let's go to Qatar, let's see what's going on. And I was like, okay. And then I went there, and then the doctor there, she asked me to do my foot like my thing, my toes spread it like that. And I couldn't spread it. I couldn't at all. And she didn't do it. I was like, I can. And she thought I have a compression nerve. She was like, this is like a compression nerve. You need to operate. We need to do an MRI right now. And then I was like, oh, actually, I have the CT of my old MRI that I did 5 days ago. And then she had a look at it. And she's like, good news, you don't have a compression nerve. But bad news, you have a tear of 9 millimeter. How are you even walking?
Jesus.
Oh, yes.
Wow.
And she's like, you have to be in a boot right now. No, but the thing is, this MRI was done before even I played in Qatar. So it got even worse, because she's like, how are you even walking like that right now? And I was in a boot. And then the issue wasn't, and that wasn't the issue, actually. The issue was in my heel that I have. So the fat pad that underneath my heel, it's like, it got really inflamed. So it separated from the bone. So it's like I don't have any cushion under my heel. So it's as if my heel is hitting the ground. So it's quite painful.
Yeah.
And because of that, then I tried to compensate with my doing another movement. So then I worn my plantar fascia itself.
Oof.
Yeah. So it was a big thing. So I had to find the right people. So obviously I went to the Red Bull Rehab Center in Austria, and they connected me to one of the best foot doctors in the world, Walter from Germany. And I had to take 4 PRP injections in my heel for the pad, and I had to do a lot of rehab. Yeah, it was a rough time, to be honest. It was very rough, because when you have a tear in a muscle, like a hamstring or a big muscle, obviously any injury is nasty, but this one is like, it's pain in the bones. It's not something that you can, I don't know, like, for example, like, if I wake up in the morning, like, obviously you have heard, like, how bad a plantar fasciitis can be.
Yes.
It's even worse than a plantar fasciitis. Like, it's a big injury in the foot. So I have, like, plantar fasciitis, but level 1, I have it level 10, maybe, and with other complications.
Was the doctor you went to in Germany the same one that Karim Abdel-Gawad went to?
So I have something similar to Gawad, but in a different way. So I believe, I'm not 100% sure, but this is like that same doctor. He was telling me that we're the pain case. But Karim, what happened is that the fat pad, I think, wasn't even there. Like, it was destroyed. For me, it's like, it got really inflamed, so it disconnected. So the result is the same, that we have our heel contacted the ground without any cushion or something. So it's as if your heel bone is like hitting the ground every single time you're lunging.
So now, how is it right now? Did you?
It's much better, obviously, but it takes time. But when I'm playing, thankfully, I took my time. I'm pain-free when I'm playing. Mm-hmm. But then some days, it's not as great as other days. But in terms of playing, it's fine.
It's okay. Yeah. You've had, for a normal person, for a normal human being, you've had a great season. Two semis and two finals. But last year, you won 6 times. So is there a mental barrier right now, more so than a physical barrier of getting across that finish line? Or is it like not winning at this point this year? For anybody else, your season has been fantastic. But for Noran Gohar, you obviously like to win a tournament. So is it mental at this point or is it physical?
I think the first tournament back was Florida. Mm-hmm. And I lost within 2 points.
Yep.
In a 100-minute match.
Yep.
And usually when I lose, I'm not very happy, obviously. But I was very positive after that match because it was like, I went into this tournament not expecting anything from myself. Mm, like, these players have been playing whole tournament, whole year. I've been away. Like, I've been literally like in home, at home, like 3 months doing nothing. I can't do anything because, again, your foot is the thing that is holding your whole body. So if it's not healthy, you cannot do anything. I couldn't even solo because I can't put my spitting on the ground. And then TUC, I was a game away from winning the whole thing. So it would have been a fairy tale if it would have won this tournament. Mm-hmm. But overall, I was very pleased with my performance. Chicago was very pleased with my performance too. I've played 2 platinum events. For me, obviously, every tournament counts, but you always look for the big ones to peak or to do the best results.
Yeah.
So when I think about this, it's 2 platinum events, 2 finals.
Really good.
It's not bad. Yeah, obviously it can get better. But for me this season, I'm trying to improve every single tournament. I'm not thinking about results in general. I'm not thinking about ranking. Obviously, I'm not thinking about ranking at all. And I always have this theory in my mind that if you're not world number one, it doesn't matter what ranking you have, 2, 3, 4, 5.
Right.
Like, it's either one or nothing for me. That's how I think about it. And me right now, I'm thinking more about performance than results, I think. And if I'm performing well and I keep on improving every single event, I hope I can get the results I want by the end of the season. And obviously by the end of the season, during the end of the season, we're having the most important tournaments towards the end. Peaking at the end of the season would be the best thing to think about it. So I'm just trying to think that way. So I feel like every season, depending on how you feel and what you have achieved, you always have a different mentality and a different mindset. You approach it in a different way. You have to take into consideration the circumstances and how you're feeling and how your body is feeling. It's not one season that is going to make a difference in someone's career. Obviously, you can win big titles, but you cannot just erase a 14-year career or a 15-year career and all the titles that you have won with one shaky season. But again, it's not a shaky season. I think it's still like a very good one, and I'm very positive with what's coming. Hopefully, yeah.
Switching gears, talking about your coach, Rod Martin, your main coach, Rod Martin. I'm curious about the dynamic between, and it came up in Chicago, you had to play Olivia Weaver. So you hit with Olivia, Rod coaches both of you. In no other sport really does that seem to be the case where 2 highly ranked players, and Olivia now is in the top 10. She plays she's probably played you 3 or 4 times in the quarterfinals since you've shared a coach. Talk about that dynamic and what it's like. And it's obviously got to be a little awkward for Rod. And it's obviously got to be a little awkward for you and Olivia, knowing that when you guys come up against each other, Rod talks to you and says, hey, here's Olivia's weaknesses. Hey, Olivia, here's Noron's weaknesses. Tell me about that dynamic and if it's awkward and maybe I'm just making up in my head and just want some drama that's not there.
No, I think, as you said, like in other sports, like you won't see this in tennis maybe,
mm-hmm.
because the coach is like all exclusive to the player.
Yeah.
But obviously, squash is not the same. A coach cannot only like coach one player. It's not affordable.
Right.
He needs to have more than one player.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, obviously, Rod doesn't go and say, hey, Noron, that's Olivia's weaknesses or not. All professional. Obviously, I've been working with Rod for 3 years. And we have had a great time together. He really helped me in my game in general. And in these cases, I don't really think about this. I think about myself. Whatever happens on tour, when people saw, hey, this player is now coached by this coach or this, I have zero interest in knowing that because I'm super focused on myself. I don't think about anyone else. I know that if I do the right thing, and I'm quite confident in my abilities, and I know that if I'm on the right track and doing the right thing, so if I'm having the best coach and I'm having the best atmosphere and the best environment and what is suiting me, then I don't really care about any other player. And beside that, I also have Haitham in my team. So in these like sensitive, or I have both to help me, like I have Haitham and I have Valmi. So they're both very experienced, very knowledgeable, very, I would say the best two coaches in the world for me. Mm. And it helps like, yeah, it's not, yeah, I just think, I don't really think it's an awkward situation because I don't think about it anyway.
Right. So with those two coaches, two high profile coaches, as you mentioned, do they get along as far as what your tactics should be and what you should do during a match? Yeah. So there's not contradictory things, like in Chicago, because of you played Olivia, Rod didn't go into your corner. Is he telling you basically the same things that Rod would tell you between games?
Yeah, for sure. You reach a point in your career where it's all about details, right? Mm. No one is going to talk about how you're going to hit the drive or how you're going to move or how. It's about very small details that make a huge difference. Like everyone can hit the ball accurately. Everyone in the top five, anyone can move physically very good. So it's all about small details that we share together and we know about it. So I just think it worked pretty well for me.
Okay, just a couple more questions and I'll let you go. Just give me your thoughts on Amina Orfi. Young player, you've been where she is. You were a star junior player just like she was, and now coming as a young player to the PSA Tour. What are your thoughts on her and what her ceiling is? Can she be a great player? Is there something she's missing? It's just so hard for me to imagine a girl that young traveling the world playing on the PSA Tour. You did it. Obviously, Nour El-Sherbini did it. Nour El-Tayeb did it. So just talk about that for a minute.
Yeah, I think obviously Amina is a great player. By the end of the day, she's like in top 20. Mm. So obviously she's there already. It's not like she's upcoming. But yeah, as you said, I feel me and Sherbini, for example, it's funny. The first final played together, I think it was the British Open or something. We were 18 and 20 years old.
Right.
It's crazy to think about that. That was like 7 years ago. No, actually more. It's 9 years ago.
9 years ago, yeah.
That was 9 years
ago. You're 27, Nour. 9 years. You're 27.
I'm 26. I'm 26. Hard to believe. 26, please. Don't add a year. Yeah, and I've always been like the youngest player. Like I've won the youngest player award for 3 times. And I've always been the youngest. And obviously, right now, is living her dream of when you play at that age, there is nothing expected from you. It's always about the other players being afraid from you. And they don't want to lose to you. And there's real pressure on you. And you're playing the best boss. I remember at that time, I played the likes of Nicole and Laura and Camille. And that was the best time of my life. Like, I would go there. I just enjoy being with the top players that I've been watching since I was a kid. I remember, so obviously it's not a secret, but Nicole has been my idol since I was very young. I had her pictures all over my room. And I remember I was 10 years old. The first time I saw her, she was playing a teams event in Egypt for 2010. And the Malaysia was playing against Egypt, actually. And obviously I went to watch the match, obviously cheer on Egypt, but most importantly, to see Nicole for the first time ever.
Right.
And then 7 years later, I was with her on court and actually beating her for the first time. And it's just crazy. Like, when you think about it, you just think that cannot happen. So in terms of, obviously, she's living this, and this is the best feeling you can get. And it's always about phases in life. I feel like there's this phase where you're a great player. So obviously, there is no pressure on you and you do a lot of stops and you do a lot of upsets, and it's only like a pink world. Like, there is nothing expected from you. And then there will be a phase where the pressure is going to be there, and it's about how to manage this pressure. Mm-hmm. And I think we all pass through this phase where the expectation was very high, and you go through a phase where you feel like it's not working as well as it you used to work. And then because you're a great player, you're going to figure it out. It's going to take some time. But that's when experience kicks in. Mm-hmm. I feel you have to lose some matches and you have to gain the experience of how to handle this kind of pressure. And then you get back, and then, and that's I think how all of us like went through the path of getting to the top. Yeah, all of you are gonna get there. When and how? That I don't have an answer for.
No,
that.
No, for sure.
And at the end of the day, I see her as another opponent, obviously. So, and again, as I told you, like, I always focus on myself and hope the best for all other players. But I just focus on myself.
So, speaking of focusing on yourself, now that the tour is over, starts to head to Egypt. So, we have Black Ball coming up. We then have Alguna and obviously the World Championship. So, I'm always curious about players, especially players like you who live in Connecticut now, full time, really. I would assume you'd stay between Black Ball and Alguna because they're so close to each other. Would you come back to the U.S. between Alguna and the World Champs, or do you stay out in Egypt and acclimate yourself and knowing that there's only 9 or 10 days between?
Yeah, until now, the plan is to stay in Egypt because with the jet lag, it's very hard to go back and forth. Mm-hmm. As you said, it's only 10 days difference. And obviously, before a big tournament like Egypt, like the World Champs in Egypt, like, you want to be there at least 5-6 days before that. So it doesn't make sense to just go back to the U.S. for 3 days. So we always try to see the circumstances and see what's going to be best. And to you have some resources under your hand, and then you just play around that. And then you're like, okay, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that. Obviously, I discuss it with my team, and then we find the best solution for me. And then we go from there.
So I was asking this to some of my friends who are big squash people. Big squash fans. The Olympics are coming up in 2028 in Los Angeles. Right now, the thought is that the Olympics are going to be a draw of 32 for the men, 32 for the women. That's what we're hearing anyways. Yeah. I know nothing's been settled. Seeing that's what's going on in London right now with the 2 out of 3, would you prefer the Olympics would be a full 48 draw with 2 out of 3 or 3 out of 5 with a 32 draw?
No, I don't understand the question. 3 out of 5.
So in other words, normal squash, like 32 draw, play best 3 out of 5 like it normally is. Or yeah. If they said, hey, look, we can expand the draw to either being a full platinum event or 60, even 64, but it has to be 2 out of 3. More players get in it, more players are involved, but it's 2 out of 3. Which would you prefer if you had a choice? If there was such a choice.
2 out of 3 of what? Of the countries?
No, the matches are played best 2 out of 3 like they're being played in London.
Best of 3. Oh, best of 3. Oh, okay.
You know that's what you're playing tomorrow, right?
I know.
Okay.
Actually, I need to tell you something about that. The first World Tour Finals I played, I was 17. Uh-huh. And I was being put in the pool matches with Laura Massaro, Nicole David, and Amanda, I think. It was in Dubai. Uh-huh. And I was playing Laura first match. And the ref, first time ever for me, I have no clue what I'm doing here. And the ref goes, go hard to serve, Massaro to receive, best of 3 games, love all. And I finished the game. I think I lost the first game by 5 break or something. And I went out and my dad was coaching me. And I told him, I was like, did he do a mistake? He said best of 3. He said, no, you're playing best of 3, actually. No, tomorrow I know that I'm playing best of 3, so... Going back to the question.
Yeah, I probably didn't phrase that question the best, but...
No, for me, to be honest, I don't mind both formats. I don't mind this, I don't mind that. Like, I've won World Tour Finals twice when it was a best of 3 format, mm-hmm. So I think I should be pretty good at this as well. Best of 5, we're used to it. Obviously, I played everything as a best of 5. But obviously, the involvement of more players would be great, mm-hmm. So... Yeah, if it's 48 players and we play best of 3, I don't mind that for sure.
Yeah, because if it is 32 players, I've been saying, and I'm sure it's no secret, the Egyptian Olympic trials could be the best tournament ever played in the history of squash. If it was played, it would be like not a must-see viewing for sure with all those.
No, I think if it's like that, it would be, no offense, but it would be even stronger than the Olympics.
Oh, no. 100% correct. Last question. So what I do is when I have someone on, I let people know. And so they write in email questions. So I have two email questions for you. So one's very easy and the other one maybe not so easy. You let me know. So the first one is from Caitlin from New York City. She wrote, Noran, what is your favorite ice cream? Do you eat ice cream when you're not training and before and after matches? And what's your favorite flavor of ice cream?
I love ice cream. Actually, when I was young, that was my when I have a good solo session or something, my mom would take me for ice cream. In some club ice cream. I would say blueberry frozen yogurt, like ice cream.
So that's the easy one. This one's a little more difficult, so you take your time answering this. So this one comes from another huge fan of our show. It's Hanya from Cairo. Hanya from Cairo writes, "It seems like the players from Egypt are very close, often coaching each other, watching each other's matches. Are there any players you don't get along with on the PSA tour? Any other players?" And that's coming from Hanya from Cairo.
I think that the answer is quite obvious. I got the answer.
Thank you, Noren. I appreciate you being such a good sport. I appreciate you very much for you taking the time and joining the show.
Thanks for listening to another show on SQR Squash Radio. We really do appreciate you taking the time to listen, and we have a quick ask. In an effort to help us grow, if you have a quick minute, please consider sharing an episode with a friend who might be interested, or leaving a rating on any of the platforms you listen to your podcast. It would mean a lot to me and the rest of the team. Thanks so much, and have a great day.